Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast of Who's Here in the Hamptons. I'm Dan Rettiner, your host, broadcasting from my home in the Hamptons, where I have lived for over 55 years. I've written a dozen books about this glorious place, and I've seen it grow through the years from small tourist towns, quaint fishing villages, and a summer playground for high society, to what it is today, a world-class resort for celebrities, artists, musicians, authors, and billionaires. In my podcast, I will bring you interviews with not only these people, but also prominent local people who have helped shape the Hamptons. Welcome to Dan's Talks. My guest today is Charles Hertzfeld, filmmaker and a podcaster and member of the board of the Artist Writers Baseball Game. We'll talk a bit about that, but want to let you know. Charles, how are you connected up with the game? How did you get involved with that?
It was a series of accidents, accidental meetings. I knew about the Artists and Writers Game for my entire childhood and adult life. My family has owned homes out on the East End from my day of birth in 1962 through to 2011 when we sold our homes.
Let me just mention to everybody listening, this is an annual baseball game between artists and writers that's been taking place for over 420 years. Well, no, not quite. I think since 1947 in East Hampton behind the supermarket.
Yeah, it's a grand old event. And I collided with it in a series of discussions. The first was with Leif Hope. When I met with Leif Hope, I was not made a member of the board. It was over a New Year's Eve dinner with Ronette Riley.
Yep.
And she was sitting with me at Bilbocay for New Year's Eve. It was, you know, a fun evening. And we were talking about the game, and I was talking about how I knew Leif and my years out on the East End and how much I admired and loved the Artists and Writers event. I also told her that in the 90s, I used to manage a softball team in Manhattan for a company that no longer exists, but it was a grand old group called Technicolor. I used to be one of the lead executives at Technicolor New York, and we were in the Film and Media League in the 90s playing against companies that were distributors at the time, those many of which are no longer around, like Miramax and Artisan, stuff like that. And then Focus.
Tell me a little bit about your film career. How did you get involved in it? And what I know you did The Departed in 2006.
Yep.
And in 2006, you did The Butler. Did that win awards, that one?
Say that again, The Butler? The Butler did not get an Oscar. I believe it was the same, Lee Daniels, an old friend of mine, he directed that. That was the same year that I think 12 Years a Slave was nominated and won. I think that film may have been unfortunately bypassed. There was a fair amount of controversy with it. It had to do with the title itself. Warner Brothers sued Miramax for the title The Butler, and they changed the title to Lee Daniels The Butler. And then things got a little shaky because, in general, the drum roll was beginning for Harvey Weinstein, even though Me Too had not begun. And there was a bit of a distaste about him, and he was getting poked at. So he didn't get a chance to raise the flag for that film, even though certainly Miramax was very successful with the campaigns.
What was your role in that? Did you write the script?
I'll tell you what my role was. No, Danny Strong wrote the script, and Lee, my role, I've been in the industry for, this is now my 40th anniversary of being in the film business.
Yes.
So I started in 1984. I was in production. I was out of college. I worked as a PA. I worked on films, in documentaries and commercials and industrials and anything I could get my hands on. I worked at an old movie theater. So I started out as a visual artist, and I stayed in film. I never left. But production in 1989, I started to get involved in post-production, And I went to go work for a film lab in 1989 called DuArt. It no longer exists, but back then it was sort of the lab of New York. Then I went to go work for Technicolor. And for 25 years, from 1990 until the end of 2014, I worked at Technicolor. And during those years, much of my filmography emerged because I was sort of the person who managed all of these feature film projects inside the lab during all of my career. And that's why my interactions with the filmmakers like Martin Scorsese, Sidney Lumet, Spike Lee, Robert Altman, you know, the list goes on.
What, be specific about what it is you did.
Oh, back then, I was involved during production from day one in dealing with every day's photochemical processing, printing, and delivery of dailies to set for directors and directors to screen with their actors and editors to cut. And so I was involved from the first day of principle when the film was edited, finishing the film back then photochemically, later on digitally. And I spent my life working in all of the stages of post-production picture, then ultimately in sound and a little bit of visual effects. And today I work for myself, not for a company that serves the needs of the industry. I actually supervise and work for producers as a post-producer of films. And I also originate films as well. Don't get me wrong. I work with people who develop scripts and produce actual projects. But back in my early era, I was working for filmmakers who were finishing films that they initiated and created.
So this would be like setting the weather and coloring and stuff like that. And
yeah, it was all of the look of the film was established in the work that myself and my colleagues did. And this was quite significant in the photochemical era.
Yeah.
Guys like Spike Lee, who was very challenging in the creative choices that he made with films like Clockers, Girl Six, Oliver Stone with U-Turn, Summer of Sam, Inside Man.
Yeah.
These were all films that used very courageous photochemical processes involving, some cases, processing reversal in a color negative bath, otherwise known as cross-processing. Processing negative and skipping the bleach tank and desaturating the color, some of them very high risk, like what Matty Libetic did on the film Inside Man, where he cross-processed reversal and skipped the bleach in all of the interrogation scenes in Inside Man, where there's immense halation and light flowing over the characters. You have to do a lot of testing and figuring out how to do it. And when you're working with great artists, they rely on that process and that supervision. So I was sort of front and center for every cinematographer that would come into New York to shoot a film. And in 2003, I became, as a result, an associate member of the American Society of Cinematographers as an associate when we built the first digital facility for Technicolor in New York. I was sort of nominated by the community and the Guild of DPs to do that. And to this day, I'm very, very close with some of the greatest cinematographers out in the world in general.
So you're a New Yorker through and through then?
I'm a New Yorker through and through. I was born in Manhattan on the Upper East Side.
Where did you go to school, college?
And I went to college up in Massachusetts. I went to college, Clark University in Worcester. I grew up much of my childhood in Europe, in Brussels, Belgium, from 1972 to 79, because my father was relocated there.
Was he a military man?
No. He was the managing director for a large mining company from South America that had a headquarter office in Brussels.
I see. So you're really the classic New York. I was going to say sophisticated, but that's the wrong word. It was like You're the what part of the city do you like the most?
Oh, that's a great question.
Yeah.
You know, I as a kid we were forced to be in Yorkville in the Upper East Side because you know my father was a German immigrant. I'm first generation American. He was from Hamburg, Germany, and so for me, even though it's a delightful, quiet spot, it's my least favorite part of Manhattan.
What is your most?
My favorite part is where my office is in the West Village on Horatio and Washington Street in the heart of the West Village, just around the corner from the Whitney and the Meatpacking, down to Leroy Street, much of the place that I've inhabited during my working life, down that neighborhood. And then also Tribeca. I love Tribeca. Tribeca is very peaceful, especially the northern edge of Tribeca from Canal down to Franklin.
Yeah.
Very
nice. What's your favorite part of the Hamptons when you come out?
You know, funny you should mention, as a kid, it was always where our house was because we used to be on Flying Point Road at the turn of the road heading towards the public beach.
Right.
It was the old, back then in 1979 when my parents bought the house, it was part of the Burnett farm. The Burnett family owned three properties at the curve of the road, and we bought the main house from the last remaining living Burnett, which was a woman called Betty Aldrich. And she moved out of the big house and into the house in the second lot of land. And then the third lot of land was where her daughter lived. And I for me, from 1979 until 2011, that was, you know, the greatest respite for our family. And the most lovely place to be, because to me, although people talk about the Hamptons as a place where we interact and, I don't know, see people in fancy cars and, you know, lot whatever, you know, people are gazing out at the prominence of others. I always thought of the Hamptons for me as an escape. To me, it was a place where no one could see me, no one could find me. And I could be with the people who I loved in a place that I loved. And that's what the Hamptons is for me. And I think it will always be that for me. Although I hear so many points of view about the Hamptons and the lavishness of the way people present themselves. I mean, my father drove a 1979 Volvo until he passed away in 2009. So we were not the Range Rover crowd in my family. You know what I mean?
Where that turn is, I think, is that on the bay? Right on the bay?
On the bay. Yeah. When you're turning before the straightaway to the public beach, that curve in the road, we used to have the house facing the straightaway, then the land on the curve, which is now has a house on it because we sold the land. And that used to be our wiffle ball field, and we used to play croquet out there for family outings. And I had a sailboat that I pulled out onto the water. My father never wanted to sell that land while he was alive because he wanted the view to the bay. So we had the second floor of the house was one side was one bedroom with a terrace. And you went out to the terrace and you saw in the morning all of Mecox Bay. And as a little kid in 1970, 71, we had a house on Burnett's Cove at the end of Flying Point Road in a little summer shack where I had my first sunfish sailboat. And I learned how to sail on Big Fresh Pond in the Hamptons from the Frankenbach family who had the farm, the Frankenbach farm, on Big Fresh Pond. And once I passed my certification, my parents would let me sail. And I was really little. I was like 8 or 9 years old. It's kind of crazy. But I would sail out on Mecox Bay on the sunfish that pulled through the reeds out on the open bay on my own. And that's when I began sailing. And then at night, I would go to the edge of the dead end at Flying Point Road with my flashlight.
Sure.
And I would scoop up crabs at night and bring them home to my mother, which was, I'm sure, such a great honor for her to receive all the crabs.
Oh, yeah.
But well, it was so fun. Those were great years, you know? Those were big years out east, and we had lots of friends, and I used to spend my summers out as a kid from 1962 until 671. Every summer from the beginning to the end of the summer, I was with my mom out there.
So the view is of sunrise, not sunset, I guess. You're facing east.
Yes, that's right. You're right about that. Yeah. From the house, that was the way it was. When we were at Burnett's Cove at the dead end, the terraces looked due west across the bay. Gorgeous sunsets over Mikasa.
Did you ever come out in the winter? There was ice boating on that.
Yes. I remember the photographs of the ice boating, and we came out, you know, I don't think I ever saw it, and we were out there a lot of years, so I should have seen it. But yes, there was ice boating out on Mecox Bay.
Where are you staying? Do you stay out here now?
When I come out now, I stay with my girlfriend in the village. We're in an apartment on Main Street.
Which Main Street?
Main Street of Sag Harbor.
Oh, nice. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful place to just go for a stroll and meet everybody.
I love it. It's life in the village. It's a life that I never had coming out to the Hamptons as a kid, being in a house where you had to go somewhere to see people out on the street. You know, Sag Harbor is lovely.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, so tell me, we have a few minutes left. I wanted to talk to you about the conversations you've been doing.
The podcast Conversations with Charlie. Yeah, over my career, I've worked with a lot of celebrities and a lot of great directors, distributors, producers.
Right.
With a lot of amazing stories.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody approached me in 2018, end of 2018, to start doing a podcast in 2019, sort of having a sit down with all of the people that I know. So episode one, I'm pretty close with Keanu Reeves. So that was my first episode. Then John Turturro, then Ira Deutschman, who's a very well-known distributor, Bob Burney, sort of emblematic independent film distributor, Michael Hausman, Mike Figgis. During the pandemic, I did an episode with him in London, great director, Nigel Daly, head of Screen Daily. So lots of people that I've known over the years telling stories with John Turturro. You know, most of these people that you see, you don't get a chance to hang out with when you see them on a show.
Yeah.
So each of my episodes are an hour and 5 hour and 10 minutes long. You get to really hang out with these people.
Yeah, that's an hour and 10. Is that how long?
Yeah, hour 10, hour five.
We called Conversations with Charlie.
Conversations with Charlie. YouTube channel is the Pod Matrix, PODMATRIX. And there's a lot of great episodes in there with a lot of fascinating people. I'm blessed. I need to do them again. It's been a while. I did 29 episodes and I stopped.
Well, thank you for being on my podcast. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
And I'll see you at the Artist Writers Game.
You definitely will. I'm going to hopefully do better than walk and ground out this year.
It's Saturday. Well, it's the Saturday, usually around August 16.
Yes, it is. I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be fun. And thank you for having me on the show.
Did you play?
I did. I got in a little bit, but the artist team had like, I don't know, 40 people on it or something. It was crazy. I mean, by the time I had gone up to bat and been out in the field once, it was like, okay, next.
Right. Yes.
It was a fast turnover.
We were around for this incredible game about 2 or 3 years ago, where the writers got so far ahead by you got into the bottom of the ninth inning and they were ahead like 22-6 or something like that, and then they proceeded to score and score and score, and they scored. Amazing. In the bottom of the ninth inning, they actually won the game on a grand slam home run by the rabbi from the East Hampton Jewish Center. to win it like 25 to 24. It was the most amazing. It was a miracle. I've never seen miracles. That was a miracle.
That is a miracle. That must be why Leaf always brings up the rabbi.
That's right. Franklin. And I've had him on.
The other controversy about our game, of course, is it's called the artists and writers game.
Right.
But I think it's just delightful that there's so much participation. I'm not a strict about such things.
Well, I'll see you there, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Sure. Bye-bye.